Department of Fish and Game is to order with members Representative Olson, Representative Seaton, Representative Hughes, and Stoltz. Co-chair Alan Osterman is out today under the weather, and Representative Tuck is elsewhere. So we just have one item on today's docket, and that's the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, for the record, I'm Benjamin Brown. I'm one of the commissioners at the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. We are an independent agency administratively housed in the Department of Fish and Game, which is obviously why we're here before the ADF&G Finance Subcommittee. Before I go any further, I'd like to introduce some of our staff and some of our colleagues from Fish and Game. In the front row from Fish and Game are Deputy Commissioner Kevin Brooks.
He's one of your staff?
No.
Oh, okay.
These are some of our colleagues, as I said, that we get to work with at the department where we're housed administratively. And Carol Petroborg is the Acting Director of the Division of Administrative Services at ADF&G. In the row behind them are three of our CFPC staff, our Operation Manager, Shirley Penrose, our Licensing Section Project Leader, Yvonne Fink, and our Research and Planning Project Leader, Kurt Iverson. To prepare for the meeting today, I had worked with your staff, Mr. Chairman, to have copies of our most recent annual report distributed. And as that report tells you, we have four sections at CFEC. And Shirley works just directly with the three commissioners to sort of run the operations side of things. Back in the 80s, there was actually, when our staff swelled to the mid-40s in number, there was an executive director of the commission. But when after Governor Cooper said all bets were off and the price of oil got to precipitously low levels, we downsized significantly. So Shirley does the work of an executive director, but we call her an operations manager. And the reason I asked these two section leaders to be here, Kurt and Yvonne, is most contacts from the legislature requiring information tend to go to one of their two sections. Research deals with all the statistical information regarding our limited entry permits. And the licensing section, of course, deals with real Alaskans who may have problems from time to time in getting their permits renewed or trying to transfer them permanently or on an emergency and temporary basis. So I just wanted the members of the subcommittee to be familiar with their faces and their names. And certainly if there's specific questions about any of our budgetary items, Shirley would probably be more than happy, and I'm certain quite able to answer them. So.
And we'll interrupt any time a member has a question.
Absolutely, please. So where did we come from and what do we do? Well, the voters of Alaska in 1973 decided they actually wanted to amend the Constitution to allow for something different than what the default was, which was that all resources are owned in common by all the people of Alaska. Several attempts to restrict access to commercial fisheries in the 60s after statehood kept running afoul of that provision of the Constitution in Article 8. And so the voters, by a 3-1 margin, actually approved an amendment to the Constitution to allow for the limitation of entry to fisheries for some specific purposes, those being preservation of the resource and, importantly, the promotion of the economic well-being of fishermen and their families dependent upon that resource. So after the Constitution was amended, the legislature set about passing the Limited Entry Act, which created the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. And we set about, at that point, limiting entry to fisheries. And so in 1975, we took on the most pressing matter, which was a great number of the salmon fisheries. And with the passage of subsequent years, we limited more salmon fisheries, herring for roe, all sorts of sable fish and crab varieties, all the way up through 2004 when we did our most recent limitations of traditional limited entry, not vessel-based, and we may have a chance to chat about that in a moment. But traditional limited entry is based on the concept that a permit holder is an individual flesh and blood person. Not necessarily an Alaskan, and I actually had an inquiry from a staff person earlier this session as to why do we even give these permits to non-Alaskans, and who made that idea? Well, even there were some of those unsuccessful attempts in the 60s to limit entry had problems with Alaska's constitution, but they also ran clearly afoul of the United States Constitution's Privileges and Immunities Clause, which allows residents of one state to enjoy the privileges and immunities of all the states in the Union. And so we just can't say, I'm sorry, you don't get a dividend, you don't get a limited entry permit. As you are all probably aware, Mr. Chairman, that was what the original dividend scheme ran aground on the rocks of, which was that it was too preferential to Alaskans and discriminatory towards non-Alaskans. So over time, about 75% of all of our permits have remained in the hands of Alaskans. But there's certainly a lot of fishermen from Oregon, Washington, California, and indeed, if you look at a chart, almost every state in the union, I think at one point, Rhode Island didn't have any, or Maine, but I mean, it really is very, and then there's also fishermen in Norway, sometimes in Switzerland, so there are a lot of interesting variety of people who hold our limited entry permits. Now, those permits don't guarantee anyone a certain share of any of the species that they're for. They guarantee someone the right to go out when the Department of Fish and Game opens a fishery and to do his or her best to try to harvest that up to whatever limits are set by Fish and Game. But they are, nevertheless, a valuable asset. They are prized possessions for those who hold them. And original permits issue originally once a fishery is limited on the basis of the applicant's prior participation in the fishery and their relative economic dependence on the fishery in contradistinction to other sources of income that they may have. And there's also a provision called unavoidable circumstances or extraordinary circumstances, depending on the fishery, which allows a fisherman who didn't go out and land fish in one of the years that's necessary to earn a permit to say, well, I would have but for this very specific reason that prevented me from doing so, a medical condition that arose out of nowhere or some sort of catastrophic, unforeseeable event. And no one pays to get an initial permit issued. When the commission decides we're going to limit entry to a fishery based on a petition to do so because of a demonstrated scarcity and possible conservation problems and possible problems for the well-being of the fisherman dependent, then we set a limitation date, we have a look-back period, and in that look-back period there are certain years where you have to have landed some fish in order to be eligible to apply at all, and then in all the years you will get additional points for a certain quantity of fish and for being able to prove income dependence or investment in a boat. And so once those merit-based determinations are made, sometimes when a fisherman is told, you're not going to get a permit, you didn't catch enough fish, or we didn't sometimes believe that you claimed that you caught them, they have had the right to appeal that from a hearing officer to the full commission. They can request that the full commission review that determination on administrative review, and then of course they can exercise their rights as Alaskans and Americans and go to Superior Court, and if they don't like what the Superior Court judge decides, they can take it all the way up to the Alaska Supreme Court. And many fishermen have done that, and that's created the body of case law that was described by one actual current member of the Alaska Supreme Court, who I think will be speaking tomorrow to you at the State of Judiciary Address, as being arcane. And as an attorney of a little over a decade's experience, and now having been on the commission,
so I don't have to go now since I've already heard this.
Thank you. I wouldn't do that to Chief Justice Fabe. She's a very good speaker. I'm sure you wouldn't want to miss what she has to say. But at any rate, it is somewhat arcane. It's very specific to our agency. And CFEC, when you look at other states, and when I see people from other states in some context, they ask what CFEC is, and it's a little difficult to explain. So hopefully my presence here today will, and I know obviously Representative Seaton, you're quite familiar, and Representative Stoltz, Representative Hughes perhaps not so much, Mr. Chairman, and we just want to be there for everyone, because it's not something you may have.
Is that because she's from the Valley, or what?
No, there are quite a few permit holders from the Valley, where, by the way,
yeah,
for the record.
I just wonder if you were making any broad generalizations.
Being a Palmer Moose myself, Mr. Chairman, I would never make a negative.
I just didn't want any besmirchments unintentionally by a Juneau guy.
No, absolutely. Yes, okay. A former Valley boy, absolutely.
Okay.
So that's kind of the 30,000-foot view of what we do as an agency. And the other divisions whose project leaders are not here are the Adjudications Division and the Information Technology section. And IT, of course, is playing a larger and larger role in all areas of our lives in state government. And we're trying to be ahead of the curve in providing services to our constituents, to fishermen, by having the ability to renew their permits online and vessel licenses online. And certainly for the research section, a great number of the research reports that are generated by our hardworking and talented research staff are there as well. So it's a lot of information, very transparent, very easy for people to access and learn more about specific fisheries. Now, not everything is online, and that's because we also have a provision in Title 16 where we are enabled to exist that mandates confidentiality. So there's certain forms of information about a fisherman's economic activities that we are not able to release. And we, when we think that there's a gray area, we consult with our assistant attorneys general at the Department of Law and make sure that we are obeying the law, because that's what we want to do as a good state agency. So I don't know if everyone had a chance to look through the annual report. We are mandated to produce this document every year. And it, we do try to give kind of a really good picture of what we do. We always, so on page three, there's an organizational chart that shows the commission and how we're set up and each of the project leaders. On page four and going all the way over to page seven is a description of some of the activities we took. This addresses calendar year 2011. And we created this report last year, 2012. We will have a report for calendar year 2012 out sometime after, by the end of this fiscal year is what we're going to shoot for. But if there are specific things that are of interest to any of your members, Mr. Chairman, certainly we could try to provide an answer in advance of getting the final 2012 annual report out. So with that, I don't know if anyone has any specific questions. There are a couple of things that are mentioned in the decisions and activities section I would hazard a guess might be of more interest to you than some other things.
Representative Hughes.
Yeah, I have a very general question. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Brown, i.e. Ben. I am the newcomer here, so I'm going to ask rather a basic question. Are you adjusting annually the number of permits that are issued? Is that something that's looked at, or is it a set number?
No. When a fishery is limited, we establish a maximum number, and we've been told by the, Mr. Chairman, if I may, we've been told by the Supreme Court that can be no less than the highest number of units of gear that were fished in the four-year period before that limitation date. And so we set a maximum number. Everyone who is eligible to apply gets an interim use permit, and then a long process of adjudication goes on to figure out who's going to get a permanent transferable permit. So the only way we adjust the number of permits in a fishery where limitation has gone through that entire process is when someone relinquishes one voluntarily. I just don't want this permit anymore. That's an odd choice to make if it has monetary value, because they could transfer it if it's a transferable permit and get money for it. Or sometimes people don't pay their renewal fees. And after renewal fees aren't paid for 2 years, Yvonne contacts them and says, you're about to lose your permit and you need to catch up on that. And then permits go away very, very infrequently for that reason primarily. But once a fishery's been limited and there are this many permits out there, assuming people are behaving rationally, they're not just going to relinquish them and destroy them. Now, another exception I would say, though, however, are fleet consolidation or reduction measures. And in the last year, the Southeast Revitalization Association, which is a group here in Southeast Alaska, which was recognized by the legislature and given the power to conduct the buyback, actually used some money that Senator Murkowski helped get from the Federal Department of Commerce, the National Marine Fisheries Service, to reduce the size of the Southeast salmon purse seine fleet by buying back permits, because the collective belief was that there were too many permits out there and they were no longer as valuable as they would be, and there was too much firepower, too much capacity out there doing that harvesting. So that's another limited exception to the rule that once a permit comes into existence, it really has no reason to cease existing, because someone can give it to his or her son or sell it to another fisherman.
Representative Hughes.
Follow up to my Palmer Moose person here. Thank you. Typically, it's not done. When you issue the permits, are you controlling where the person with the permit may fish? Is location part of it?
Yes. Every single fishery is for a geographical area, which can be statewide or it can be something much smaller, and it's for a specific species and it's for a specific gear type. So our permits have identifying codes S01A, and one letter denotes the geographic region, the number of the species, and then the second letter, the gear type. And so, yes, inherent in a permit can be a restriction on where it can be used geographically. But many permits are statewide.
And as follow-up to that, and again, as a Palmer Moose grad, I'm going to pull on that, because now I'm going to zero in, get a little closer to my home and my constituents and the concern about a number of fish going up the rivers and Cook Inlet. Is there, if we wanted to remove some nets from the upper Cook Inlet so we could get more fish to the rivers, how could we go about doing that? And could we just terminate the right to hold a permit? Could we buy them back? Or how could we get that done if we decided that's what we wanted to do?
That is a fully allocated fishery, and you can discuss how that figures into your equation, Mr. Brown.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, to respond to Representative Hughes's question, we don't make allocation decisions. Our friends at the Board of Fisheries have the challenging pleasure of doing that, and they'll be doing that in a meeting starting next week. We are often called upon to work with them when there are some critical situations going on, and there is an Upper Cook Inlet Set Net Salmon Task Force that's going to be meeting soon, and our chairman, Bruce Twomley, has been asked by the chairman of the Board of Fisheries to participate in that process. Because permits are valuable assets and they don't go away of their own accord, and then there are scarcity issues and allocation decisions made because of scarcity, it does double back to our agency, and we certainly could have a role to play. Many people think that there should be less firepower, less fishing capacity in many of the Cook Inlet fisheries. And can't argue with that logic. We aren't going to conduct the buyback unless the legislature tells us we have to do so. Now, you said, could we just take some of them away? And if the we you're referring to, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hughes, is the legislature, you absolutely can. Since the Limited Entry Act was first enacted, there's been a very explicit provision that these are revocable at the legislature's decision. So it's not, even though they have value, and you can sell one to someone else, and you can go out and fish with one and make money, if the legislature in its wisdom decides there are too many permits or we don't want any permits, I've never seen a bill like that, but it could be done. And so that is definitely a legislative prerogative. I think because the language has been in the statute since the inception of limited entry, I don't know that if I were an attorney, I would want to take on someone's claim that that was an unconstitutional taking and they were deprived, you know, consideration for the permit, because they've been on notice since the Limited Entry Act was first passed that what the legislature giveth, the legislature can take it away.
So what is the value of the business if the state owns the inventory? Is it the boat and the nets, or and that's if it's an overly abundant and a number of entries, that's usually means some of them aren't succeeding. Somebody else owns the inventory, would you guys be involved in establishing a value as the administrator?
Oh, no, we don't establish values, but we do monitor permit values, and we base our renewal fees on what we see those values to be. And Kurt and his staff every year do a transfer study that tracks where permits go, and we also look at prices of permits. There is an active – I think, Mr. Chairman, it's a hypothetical because there's not been this sort of wholesale decision to take away existing permits, so it's a stable market right now. If the legislature were at one point to say – we're getting rid of this entire fishery, that would probably have repercussions on the value of...
And for the record, as folks are recording this, the idea of taking away is all that conversation has been initiated by the CFEC, not by either of the Valley legislators here.
Mr. Chairman, with the proviso that we can't do it.
Okay, I just want to...
If you wanted to...
I just know how some things get a little overly dramatized, so I just want to make sure...
Fair enough.
That it is... would you confirm that neither of us have used the term takeaway permits?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to confirm that. And
Chris Tuck may be thinking it, but...
So at any rate, that's...
Who's joined us.
Thank you.
Please.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. So at any rate, there is a stable market now, and there are private brokers that engage in the business of trying to match people who are seeking a permit up with people who are seeking to get rid of a permit. And if it's a permanent transfer, the permit holder has to... post a notice online and wait 60 days, a cooling off period, after which, as long as the proposed transferee is ready, able and willing to fish the permit, then it can go forward. They're supposed to tell us what the terms of that deal are, and they face penalties for unsworn falsification if they don't. So we do our best to make sure that we are regulating the market, but we're not participants in the market.
Well, I have one quick question on, I guess it's not a quick one, on the permits themselves. Are there statutory limitations on other uses, collateral, security? Can they be liened? I assume, I don't know if anything is not subject to an IRS or a CSED lien, practically. that seems they have the first, but what are there so many, any general guidelines on statutorily and on how these are dealt with as opposed to other, I guess, properties or assets?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there absolutely are some very narrow restrictions on how a limited entry permit can be used as collateral. Only loans from two state entities, the Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank and the Division of Economic Development, formerly the Division of Investments at the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, can issue loans that actually have a limited entry permit as collateral. That's not to say some people have not engaged in borrowing or lending transactions and attempted to use the permits as collateral, but as a matter of law, that's not permissible. And if they were to tell us when they were proposing the deal that they were going to do that, we would tell them, no, then we're not going to approve the transfer of the permit. Now, Child Support Services Division is able to put liens on them. They can't force the sale of it, but they can tell us not to allow it to go through until the child support lien is satisfied. And
what does that mean? I mean, you can yank a driver's license or a professional license. What does that mean?
If someone has a limited entry permit, Mr. Chairman, and a sizable child support arrearage, and I should say in the interest of full disclosure, when I was done clerking for Judge Weeks, I did a brief stint over the Department of Revenue as an administrative law judge doing nothing but child support enforcement hearings all day, every day. It was a lovely, lovely task. And often when there's a sizable arrearage, the last thing you want to do is deprive the obligor of an asset that allows him, and it could be her, to produce income to satisfy that arrearage. So, no, it's not a matter of forcing the sale and getting blood out of the turnip over the permit, but it certainly can be a matter of, I mean, if you know the fisherman's out there fishing and you know where his accounts are, CSSD has other means of going about trying to get that arrearage satisfied. Another issue, if I may, where the issue of liens has come up, another area, is liens on permits in maritime law. So in the context of if there were perhaps a personal injury on a fishing vessel, the plaintiff's bar nationally likes the idea of trying to place a judgment lien, you know, on behalf of a successful plaintiff against the defendant permit holder. It hasn't happened. There was one case outside where we thought it might, so we actually, this was in our report, we worked with Senator Murkowski and Senator Begich and Congressman Young over the past 2 years to try to get into the Coast Guard Reauthorization Bill language that would have expressly stated as a matter of federal law, maritime law, admiralty law, that no, there is no such thing as a maritime lien. And unfortunately, and since I was a trial lawyer really through myself, I'm not speaking ill of them as a profession, but they're very well organized with the lobby in our nation's capital, and that language did not make it through the conference committee process. So it's not in the reauthorization bill. My understanding is that Senators Murkowski and Begich and Congressman Young's staff are going to continue to try to get that into federal law.
Are they doing the same thing for long-haul truckers and trying to protect them from losing their livelihood, too, or is it just...
I don't know that, Mr. Chairman, that's within the ambit of my agency.
I don't know. I think that was rhetorical, Mr. Brown.
All right, very good.
Okay. So I had interrupted Shelley, Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Chair, and I want to thank you for indulging me, Chair, and also Commissioner Brown for some of those basic questions, and you did a good job explaining them, and I might... I just want to affirm what the chair said as far as I didn't mean to be suggesting. I just want to understand how it works and also to say that you talk fast, but you're very engaging and you're easy to follow. So I'll just throw that in.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Hughes. I'm trying to talk slowly. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there are other specific questions any members of the subcommittee have or if I should turn to those two areas I was hazarding a guess might be of particular interest.
Well, I think you should talk about what you're asking for the budget and authorizations and you know, for every there's new players at the table. With the derivation of your revenues.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, yes. I am pleased to report that since our inception, CFPC has been an entirely self-supporting agency. All of our operations are paid for from the fees that we collect from the commercial fishing industry. So the most recent year for which I can give you final numbers is 2012, and our total actual budget was $3,597,400. That year, our revenues were $7,534,423.46. So as you can see, we actually yielded a surplus in excess of our operations. And I don't know if it's not in the annual report. No, this is budgetary material that's, I don't know if has the subcommittee seen it. So if I need to come back when you're actually looking at the operating budget, I'm happy to do so. But
or provide us, that's pretty basic information.
Sure, no, we can absolutely provide
that. I have not really spent time on the fish and game budget.
And Mr. Deputy Commissioner Brooks obviously could provide this as well, because everything we do runs through the administrative side of it.
What is the rule of thumb here on our boards and commissions, with absent a couple of them, the fees collected have to are self-sustaining. It's only collected amount to run those agencies plus whatever rake they need, I guess, for a bureaucracy to just barely survive, right?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I believe that mandate was put in for the occupational licensing
yes.
boards.
But I'm using it as a comparative example.
Indeed. And what happens to those excess revenues, you may be wondering, every year we make two deposits to the Fisherman's Fund, which is the workers' compensation program for fishermen in Alaska. Just as recently as the 15th of last month, we made a deposit of $132,759.40, and that's, as I said, a biennial thing. We will make a second payment in July. Last year it was $220,588. So those revenues come from a portion of the fees paid by resident and non-resident fishermen. From residents, we collect $23.40, and from non-residents, $50. And those monies go into the Fisherman's Fund so that when someone gets hurt and it's not going to go to insurance, the Fisherman's Fund has the resources to help pay for that care.
Is there a statutory direction for doing that?
Yes, and I can't give you the exact statute.
That's something you can follow up, and it's adding the compendium of shared information with this.
Yes, and the Fisherman's Fund is run by the Department of Labor, where other workers' compensation programs are run. But it's very solvent, and fortunately we've had not too many bad fishing injuries, you know, over the past few years. I know, just as an aside, Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton visited upon that issue in the House Fisheries Committee a couple of weeks ago in the context of seven-day so-called dude fishing licenses, which some crew members are buying in lieu of a non-resident crew license. And if you buy six of those at $30 apiece, you're saving $20 as against the $200 it costs for a non-resident annual license. And so that's less revenue going into the Fisherman's Fund.
I tell you, is that really? I know I hate dealing with government. I to deal with government six times instead of once for save $20. I would never do that deal. But
and Mr. Chairman, you can buy all six of them at once.
Okay.
So that's the reason. And so there are some I think ideas kicking around about how to solve that specific problem. But we're pleased to be part.
I was assuming they weren't a scurrilous lot, and you just confirmed they were. Then okay.
I haven't met any of them, but I do know that all of their names are available in a database that we got from Division of Commercial Fisheries.
And so, Mr. Chairman, when we allow fishermen to do something, we can't blame them for doing it. Mm-hmm. And so we, you know, at the time the seven-day licenses were there, we put in a provision that allowed them to get them consecutive. And so if someone goes for a three-week fishery in Bristol Bay as a non-resident, they can get their licenses for participation for less than half of a non-resident license. Or if they're only out there for 2 weeks, they get the same as a resident license. And so that is has become growing in the fleet. The fleet's knowing it. I mean, people, you know, have the opportunity to save money, and so that's what they do. And so that's, I just wanted to defend fishermen that it's not something illegal. It's something that I think, a loophole in the law. So,
Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Seaton described it well. It's a loophole in the fishing knot that rational fishermen are taking advantage of.
Well, let's get some fishing bills up in this committee, and we'll fix them.
We're trying.
So, if I may, Mr. Chairman, to go on with just a little bit more budgetary information, Governor Parnell has proposed a total budget for our agency this year of $4,313,200. The lion's share of that would be designated general funds, $4,198,800. And then there's a small amount, just shy of $115,000 in federal funds. And we're not actually anticipating receiving those. In years past, long before I was serving as a commissioner, there were some federal funds that came through CFEC. And so the authorizations being in place would enable us to expend those funds if they were given to us by Congress. Frankly, with the climate in our nation's capital these days, I don't think we're sitting around waiting for random pennies from Washington to fall. But that is the proposed budget, and we support that, and we appreciate our colleagues at Fish and Game helping us get that proposal there. We have a small additional amount in the budget as compared to last year of $21,900, and that is budgeted entirely to go for a health insurance increase of $59 per employee per month, and so to cover that additional insurance cost for the employees at our agency. Other than that, it is a flatline budget as compared to last year, and we're very happy with that, and again, we're grateful to be able to return some funds to the legislature for the use at the legislature's discretion. And Mr. Chairman, as you know, we certainly have no say over how any of that additional money that isn't going to, for our operations or to the Fisherman's Fund is going to be expended. Governor Parnell has come forward with Fish and Game with some proposed capital projects that money could go towards. And certainly there's a history of the legislature deciding on its own what it thinks some beneficial uses that almost always have a good fisheries nexus. So on the fiscal year 13 request,
it doesn't have to have a fisheries nexus, though, does it?
It doesn't. No, I mean it's.
We don't have an oil nexus to every.
No.
You know what I mean?
No, and
oh, just an observation.
No, there's just a good tradition of that, but no, it's certainly not a dedicated fund in the sense that it would run afoul of the Constitution.
There may be ways things have been done, but.
So no, if there's a higher need this year, Mr. Chairman, it's you and your colleagues' decision.
Kids and children in schools, all that other stuff.
Indeed.
That's you, Chris.
So that's kind of the most important information about our budget that I would share with you. If there are, you know, specific questions.
What are you
about
guys doing throughout the year?
Mr. Chairman, we are constantly making sure that fishermen are able to renew their permits. Fishermen often do wait until the last possible minute to do it. In some fisheries with a history of not opening, no one wants to spend the money and then have it open for a day and not get it back. If it doesn't open at all, then a fee that's been paid is refundable. But if it opens even for a little bit and someone's already paid the fee to renew the permit?
I don't understand. You know, we do all kinds of, you know, I buy a fishing license whether the drainages are open or not. Buy hunting licenses whether or not there's a, whether you draw a permit. Is that statutory or is that?
I believe it's in our regulations. Actually, I'd have to follow up with you on that.
That's, you could probably pay that $59 a month real easy just off of that.
Yes, another fisherman might not like it. As I've mentioned.
Well, I mean, I'm here to please, but you know, we're also trying to run a budget committee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, your point is well taken. The issue where it comes up, or people are most annoyed, is when there's a very, very short opening. Or there's an opening.
We've heard of those in our region.
Indeed, you have, Mr. Chairman. And to be fair, I can see why there are some sport fishermen out there who buy licenses in hopes of going out and having a great summer, and that fails to materialize, and they don't get to turn theirs back in. So
that's why they call it fishing, not catching, at least in the sport realm.
And why it's not an IFQ, Mr. Chairman, in the context of a limited entry permit. There's no guarantee that you're going to fill the nets or the pots. So I will be happy to make sure we provide the statutory and or regulatory basis for that policy. And if the legislature wanted to revisit it, assuming it were in statute, we would obey that command. And if it were in regulation, I think we would entertain that option. But I certainly know that it would probably not be.
I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just fishing right now.
Well, but we can look into that, certainly, Mr. Chairman, and provide an answer that enables you to proceed as you see fit.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Are we on budget still or back to
any topic you want?
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Ben, I'm concerned, have been for a long time, about the vessel entry permits. They don't require a person to participate in the fishery at all. And I'm fearful that the consolidation that has taken place in that fishery has reached the point where we may be running afoul of the constitutional prohibition on a special right of fishery. So, you know, I'd like you to provide the data from 2004. We've had 9 vessels that qualified for state and federal permits. And what I'd like to do is know where those boats are now and who owns the boats, who owns those permits, both the federal and state. And not just a corporate name, but the actual owners, you know, of the vessels, so that we can find out whether we have excessive consolidation that could run afoul of that. And so I know there's some information that is confidential, catch information and all, because there's so few boats participating that those, we can't even find out whether the taxes were paid. And so, anyway, that's the information I would like to get so that we can actually look at that and find out whether we have a problem that's created by the system that has run a course that we created statutorily. It's not your agency creating it. So I'd appreciate getting that information to the committee, and I'm sure we'll see you in Fisheries Committee on this as well, but at least that way there'll be more people will have access to the information.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, I just for the record, I had provided Representative Seaton's office with a table from our research section with a lot of information redacted in obeisance to our confidentiality statute. So I'm probably not, and I consulted with our attorneys, we consulted, Chairman Twombly and I, to make sure that we were giving you everything we could, but not pushing the envelope of what we're not allowed to give out. So I will, and I'm sure staff is making a note of the request, and we'll do our best to respond as fully and candidly as possible. But if I may, Mr. Chairman, you provide me with an opportunity to let all of you know that we've been working, CFEC has been working in conjunction with the Senate Resources Committee, because the vessel-based limited entry programs date back into the mid-90s, when there was a significant amount of overfishing of weather vane scallops. The fisheries had crashed over on the East Coast. Many boats came down through and around and up to Alaska and just started fishing incredibly aggressively. And the table that I previously provided shows, you know, just these ginormous amounts of scallops being caught, which actually pushed down on prices.
Ginormous?
What? Mr. Chairman, I believe ginormous is in the Oxford Dictionary now.
I'm not sure.
I think it was added a couple of years ago.
Okay.
But if not, I
would... That's okay. I would never doubt your wordsmithing or linguistics.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So
I just thought it was a cool word.
In response to that overfishing, the legislature, actually Representative Osterman sponsored a bill, a House Bill 141 back in 1997, that was directly intended to address that problem. And it's an interesting read if you look back at House Bill 141 from the 20th legislature in 1997. And for the interest of full disclosure, I was a legislative aide at the time for Senator Tim Kelly. So I was here working in this very building when this legislation went through, and it had a nice list of findings, legislative findings and intent, that underscored the need to impose the moratorium, and that actually gave the state of Alaska the power for the first time in Title 16 to manage fisheries in federal waters, whether there was no federal fisheries management plan in place or whether the fishery was, management was delegated by the federal government. The findings, if I may, Mr. Chairman, include the fact that the scallop fishing fleet was overcapitalized, that the fishing effort in the weather vane scallop fishery that was clearly threatening sustained yield management of the fishery. Those are some things that are no longer the case. I mean, it's no longer overcapitalized, and the current operation, although it may not be to Representative Seaton's liking in every way, Mr. Chairman, is not diminishing the resource. I mean, I think our friends at the Division of Commercial Fisheries will tell us that it's being very well managed and sustainably managed now.
Is this involving that? There was that kind of an ominously named boat named Mr. Big?
There was a boat of that same name that did engage in some truly shocking fishing practices in Prince William Sound in this time in the mid-90s,
Mr.
Sherman.
Okay.
So at any rate, some of the findings from Representative Osterman's House Bill 141 back in 1997 remain true. Their weather vane scallops live for a long time and have few natural predators, which makes them susceptible to overfishing, because they're there, and you know they're not hard to find. We've improved our knowledge of the stocks since the mid-90s, but it's still largely based on biometric estimates and not a lot of actual hard data is being collected. There are sled cams that the Department of Fish and Game is starting to use. They're expensive, that can actually go out there and get photographic data about how many scallops are in this bed and how big they are.
Does the fishery itself pay for those?
I do not know the answer to that question, Mr. Chairman. We'll make a note of that and see. But even though we've improved since 1997, we still don't know as much as we would like to know about weather vane scallops. Certainly remaining true today is the fact that there are problems in other scallop fisheries in the North Atlantic. Like so many of the fisheries in the North Atlantic, they've not been managed well as we've attempted to do here in the North Pacific. And so, well, scallops are scallops. I mean, ours are better and more delicious. But the fewer of the less delicious, not...
As we can do their own work.
there's going to be more demand for those scallops. And so And scallop fisheries worldwide have been known to collapse after short periods of intense overfishing. There are bycatch issues with king and tanner crab. And I guess most importantly, finding number 7 from Representative Osterman's House Bill 141 back in 1997, it remains true that the conventional limited entry system cannot adequately protect the health and stability of the weather vane scallop fishery. So there's a, as you well know, Representative Seaton, through the chair, a sunset date on the 30th of December this year, at which time vessel-based limited entry will cease to exist. It came into existence with the passage of House Bill 206 in 2002 in the 22nd legislature. And that's what instructed our agency to go forward, take the moratorium, and actually create a limited entry system that is vessel-based. And we've done what we were told to do by the legislature. I would note, just for the record, because there was not always a lot of controversy about vessel-based limited entry. When Representative Osterman's bill that listed all these problems, many of which continue to exist, passed and placed the moratorium there and contemplated vessel-based limited entry for the first time, it passed with 35 yeas in the House and 17 yeas in the Senate, and there were no nays. There were just excused and absent members. So at that point, there was a great deal of legislative consensus about the problems in the weather vane scallop fishery and about this vessel-based system being a wise way to address those problems. There wasn't as much unanimity of opinion when the vessel-based system was created by the late Representative Drew Scalzi earlier in the last decade. But House Bill 206, as originally drafted, didn't have a sunset date. It was only at the very end of the legislative process in that legislature on the Senate floor, and it was a House bill, where the sunset provision was added. And because it was the end of session, we ended up with a program that began its life in 2003 and would have ended its life, and again, through the chair, Representative Seaton, you're aware of a lot of this, by a sunset date that was set for the end of December in 2008. But in 2008, Representative Seaton actually introduced legislation to extend the vessel-based limited entry program for another period of time and held three hearings in the House Special Committee on Fisheries, but the bill did not move out of that committee. And so another bill was actually changed, and then there was a concurrent resolution to change its title to add 5 more years to the life of vessel-based limited entry. And that sunset date is the 30th of December of this year. And so we at CFEC do not feel that it would be permissible, and I can speak for myself and Chairman Twomley, we feel that we would be violating the sustained yield mandate of the Alaska Constitution if we were allowed this program to go away at the end of this year. All that being said, I can report to the committee and whoever else may be watching or listening that we've been working in conjunction with the Senate Resources Committee, and tomorrow a bill will be read across from the Senate Resources Committee as the sponsor that will prolong vessel-based limited entry for 10 more years should this bill successfully pass both bodies. Governor Parnell and Commissioner Campbell support this legislation. And so that's something we will certainly be working on. And Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Seaton is right that we will have a chance to discuss it in the House Special Committee on Fisheries and probably a good deal before we get over to the other side of the building. So I could go on at great length since I was appointed to the commission.
We're going to have to talk about this later. We've all lived some of this history, so it's probably, and I bet you everybody in the room here probably knows the history. So
at any rate,
it'll be enough later.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank for letting me go on a little bit there, because that's kind of the background of the story, and it's very important to us as an agency that we not let this vessel-based system wither on the vine and die at the end of the year. So,
Representative Seaton,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you know, time does go on and things change, and there wasn't consolidation to a very few select people at the time, which may run afoul of the other portions of the Constitution and a special right of fishery. So we need to look at this in all aspects, not just from the ease of the management. So appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, and we'll look forward to the information.
Any other questions on this matter? Hope not. Thank you.
Thanks.
We'll be talking about it later. Any other items you have?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Weather vane scallops were one of the two things that I thought might. I hazarded a correct guess there that was of particular interest to at least one, not all, the members of the subcommittee. The other area where I would hazard you, I guess you might be interested, is the Carlson case. And Carlson, of course, is the case involving the decision by the commission this is even before Chairman Twomley's time, and he's been there for three decades, to charge non-Alaskans three times as much as Alaskans for their permits. Seemed like a nice number, three times as much for a guy who doesn't live in Alaska. Unfortunately, a bunch of non-Alaskan fishermen hired an attorney in 1984 and filed a lawsuit, and they were successful in convincing the Alaska Supreme Court that we had run afoul of that very same Privileges and Immunities Clause of the United States Constitution that I mentioned earlier when discussing why we can't deny permits to non-residents. And Carlson had five iterations, and Carlson 5 was handed down in January of last year. So I thought I might, if I may, Mr. Chairman, just share some developments in the Carlson case with members of the committee. As a preliminary matter, the only way a constituent of yours is going to care about this is if he or she was a non-resident when being overcharged and has now moved back to Alaska.
I think every constituent cares because we put $83 million in escrow from the general fund. So it's, I think it's a broad statewide interest.
Excellent.
I am still choking on that bile. I couldn't rinse and spit enough, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, point well taken. In April of 2010, before Carlson 5 was handed down, the Superior Court, Judge Michalski in Anchorage, approved a stipulation between the plaintiff's class and us as the defendant, CFEC, that if the state paid $82,290,295.94 into an escrow account, that they would waive any interest they might otherwise be due after the 31st of January of 2010. And, Mr. Chairman, we thank the legislature for trusting that we were perhaps going to do well and win on a final argument in that case and putting that money into the account, because our attorneys did an outstanding job and were successful in Carlson 5. The issue there being, what sort of interest would be due on an overpayment made by a non-Alaskan fisherman? Plaintiff's counsel, unsurprisingly, wanted the highest rate possible, which is a punitive rate in Title 43, which deals with tax refunds. The issue being, if you overpaid your taxes and you were right about it, you should get a little bit more interest when you're made whole when that's been adjudicated. And we were right that that's not what they were entitled to. They were entitled to simple interest under Title IX, the Alaska Code of Civil Procedure. Well, that victory reduced the amount due from $82 million to $33 million. And so on the 19th of October of last year, I actually have as an anchorage for other business, and I was able to attend a hearing. Judge Michalski retired. I think he was the fifth judge, the fifth judge of the case is Judge Guidi now on the Superior Court bench up in Anchorage. And Judge Guidi approved a stipulation that $49,784,962.22 would go back to the state, and those were transferred back, Mr. Chairman, in December of last year.
And we were told by our folks in the Department of Law that that's been, and Administrative Services, that's been put back into the general fund.
So
is that your understanding?
We never expected to be able to keep the funds at CFEC, but I would not see any accounting reason why that would not be the case.
Nobody gets to try to grab it.
That's right. So of the final amount approved in August of last year of $33,305,327.72, that money has not all been paid out. The plaintiff's counsel selected when we got close to settling the case, but not the interest issue. The plaintiff's counsel suggested a class action payment management firm in Milwaukee called AB Data. And so the AB Data has the $33 million. And the first round of checks was sent out the second week of January. And so Carlson class members are getting money, or their estates are, because many of them have passed on to the next world by the passage of time. That money's all going to stay where it is. Because a lot of the claimants have disappeared. And so there's going to be more money in that fund than probably is actually claimed. But Judge Guidi has set another status hearing for October of this year, which hopefully I'll be in Anchorage again, and I'll have the pleasure of attending that, because I think there's certainly the possibility that some of the class members may decide that there are unresolved issues. I can tell you that we had the potential of having, 9,000 fishermen requesting hearings because they didn't agree with the amount of the refund that our records indicated they were entitled to. AB Data has made some interesting choices. When it sent out the accountings to the fishermen, half of them went out not in chronological order. So immediately confusing, making the fishermen think, well, these numbers are out of order. I'm getting shorted on how much money I get. It didn't make any difference to the bottom line. AB Data also didn't put any notice on the forms of the accountings that the attorneys, the plaintiff's class attorney, was going to get a percentage of that money for his services. That stated, we've had initially a pretty high number of calls and emails. We set up a dedicated telephone line and email address. And many fishermen, outside fishermen, have called up and said, I don't think this is right, or I don't think that's right. And we've had very few formal requests for hearings, but informally we've fielded hundreds of calls. And generally speaking, Yvonne's staff and she have been able to provide computer printouts of the permit renewals in question. Everyone seems to have forgot that in 1989 they already got a refund because of that oil spill. Often people forgot that, oh, I bought the permit from someone who'd already paid the renewal fee for that year, or it was only an emergency transfer that I had the permit, and therefore...
How many people said, my gosh, I don't deserve this, I'm going to send it back, this just isn't right?
Mr. Chairman, I personally haven't had anyone say that to me on the phone, and none of my colleagues. So it's really actually been pretty satisfying to be able to answer people's questions and explain why they're getting what they're getting, and many of them have said, well, thank God, I just wanted to get this before I died, you know, and they really do sound like they've been waiting a long, long time. So we are very proud of our attorneys at the Department of Law, Lance Nelson.
What was the issue on attorney's fees? What was the resolution of that? That was another contentious.
That's really between the plaintiff's class, the plaintiff's class and plaintiff's counsel. I could get you a specific, I did not bring that as a specific note because that was never going to come out of CFEC, the amount that came back to the state, that was going to be a matter of allocating how much the plaintiffs got and how much their attorney got. And so I would be happy, and I'll make a note of that.
There, I thought there was a separate issue where there was a settlement amount they had on attorney's fees, but my memory may be faulty.
I will confer with our law specialist, who will probably know exactly what it is you're thinking about. I can talk to Mr. Nelson at the Department of Law as well and get you an answer. But we are very grateful that we do see the light at the end of the tunnel and that come this October we may actually have an order finally shutting the case down. There will be no Carlson 6, and we've learned our lesson about what we can constitutionally charge a non-resident fisherman for a permit renewal fee.
I am trying to think, when I came in as a freshman, I think this was one of the first issues, and there was a statutory revision to roll back the fees, and the amount was about 20-odd million then. And when I was co-chairing finance in 2010, we put 82 in the change in the capital budget. So it had a steady climb. So could have been much worse.
Mr. Chairman, I know that when I first came to work here in 1991, you were working, I believe, for Senator Cotton in the office adjacent to mine. I know he always has had a very keen interest in fishermen's issues. And I know at that time even it was something that was a hotly debated issue here in the Capitol.
Representative Hughes.
Yeah, since the Carlson case seems to be coming to an end, can we conclude that cable TV commercials with 800 number for the fishermen to call will now stop?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hughes, not till the hearing this October. I think once Judge Guidi's gavel comes down, then that may end. And Mr. Chairman, I have to apologize. We were told we had to place those ads so that people knew about it. So.
You actually, there were actually ads. I was just kidding. There really were.
Well, I don't know, if, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if they're running on late night TV. There certainly were in fishermen's journals and other places where we thought we were likeliest to reach the plaintiff's class and inform them of the fact that this was happening.
As soon as we get a question from Representative Olson, we can leave. No, I'm just kidding. Are we done yet? That'll work.
Where was Lance Nelson before he was?
I know he was in departmental. I dealt with him on law issues. I don't remember.
Mr. Sherman, Mr. Nelson's been an assistant attorney general doing work for my agency and other natural resource agencies for as long as I know. So.
That's my question.
All right. And you'll get back to Representative Olson on that?
Yes.
With that.
Mr. Chairman, I can just give you Lance's number. I have a direct line at the Department of Law in Anchorage. I'm sure he'll take your call.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you, everybody. I appreciated the free-flowing, lighthearted dealing with some serious issues. We think we got a lot of information over the course of the time and that we spent here. So we will be back together on Thursday, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. With that, we're adjourned.